This is the Toronto Today podcast. I'm your host, Greg Brady.
640 Toronto presents Think Tank, the breaking stories you care about, facts and opinions that get you through the day. Now, let's meet the guests.
Let's do that on this Monday morning, 29th of April. We say good morning to Anthony Fury, a 640 Toronto contributor on a pretty frequent basis. Nice to have you on.
Good morning, Greg.
And Anne-Marie Akins, Crisis Communications Advisor, joins us as well. Lovely to have you. I hope you had a good weekend.
It was a great weekend.
Well, then you must not have been driving downtown, but I'll save that for our third topic in just a little bit. Let's get to this on the cell phone front. We're going to talk to Stephen Lecce after the 8 o'clock news. We just had Muna Kadri on, an OSSTF local president, who I thought made some great points. Bottom line, everybody's on the same page that this is a problem. The issue is empowering teachers. The issue is balancing what parents and kids are demanding and what's best for them. Here's some of the education minister from yesterday's news conference.
At its core, this is an educational overhaul for the student, the teacher, and even the parent.
Okay. We've got a bit of a phenomenon here, Anne-Marie, and it's a mental health crisis amongst our youth, I think, relative to previous years. We could argue about kids being isolated with virtual learning, school closures, but we'd all agree our kids' development has to come first and foremost. But as you know, there's some question as to whether is this just the same policy as 5 years ago, and what will give teachers and educators teeth to say, oh, you're using the phone in the class? Not anymore. Because I think they'd all agree they haven't felt empowered and emboldened to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's what we're looking at is a really complex problem that is, part of a bigger issue, as you stated, about mental health and about how we have almost encouraged and set kids up to be really connected to their phones, just like their adults, like just like the parents are. So I that was encouraged during the pandemic because we were all so isolated. But what it is, it's one of those larger systemic kind of problems that we have. And we look at a populist, simplistic answer by implementing a really difficult to police ban. And bans really don't work. They really don't work to address issues that are this big in nature. And I completely agree with your previous speaker that you had that about, our kids, the classrooms are packed, the kids are distracted, they're anxious. And of course, just like adults, you reach for your phone. So this is going to be ineffective and it's just going to set up yet another problem.
So let me follow there. Are you skeptical it can work in practicality? And then if it can't, what do we do?
I just don't think it's going to work. It can't work. Bans don't work because it then just focuses the problem on policing. And the teachers don't have time to do their work now, let alone to, and now I have to police it and I have to, let's focus that the problem is the phone, when the problem really isn't the phone. The problem is the larger issues that kids are dealing with. And if we focus on a simplistic answer, a solution, then all we're going to do is chase that simplistic answer.
It does. I think Anne-Marie makes a strong point, Anthony, in that it's going to take some work to sort of claw things back. And it may never be like it was when we went to school, where it was fairly obvious. No ball caps, no transistor radios. No, you couldn't. I can't pull out a Sports Illustrated and start reading, especially the swimsuit issue. I can't pull that out and start reading it in the middle of a history lecture in high school. I know that. I know what's going to happen to me, but I just don't know. We'll never get back there, but maybe we can find some middle ground on what's acceptable and what's not in each individual classroom.
I think one of the biggest problems right now, Greg, is that kids are in a consequence-free school environment. It's a problem. It has to change. I fully support this policy, and I fully support empowering teachers so that they can bring in consequences, and they will be backed up by their board, by their principal, by their superintendent. The phones are a problem. You bring that out one more time, Johnny. It's in my desk. You're not getting it back until end of day. That used to happen to us all the time, Greg, when we were kids. We need to bring that back. Now, in the minister's remarks he played, it was very interesting that he talked about it change and referenced for parents as well. And I think part of the problem is my generation of parents, they are not backing teachers up. I hear so many stories from friends who are teachers I encounter who, it used to be, Greg, if my parents found out that I had gotten a poor mark on a test or that I had to stay back after class or during lunch, they would say to me, And what did you do to deserve that? We got to have a talk with you, son. Now what happens? I'm shocked to learn this, but I hear it more and more, is that the parents say, I can't believe the teacher did that to you. I'm going to have a word with that teacher. They're clearly getting something wrong here. That is unacceptable. And I think part of the problem is that if you do confiscate a kid's cell phone, the parents might end up complaining. And that's not acceptable at all either.
Well, I think that's it. And we're running. I worry, Anthony, and I'll come back to Anne-Marie on this. I worry we're running schools like it's a car dealership and the customer is always right. No, they're not. And I get it. Teachers saying there's no infrastructure. We need to be able to lock these phones up. We need to obviously we got to free ourselves from some of these liability issues. But not having infrastructure, Anthony, is no reason not to deal with it. If a student brought a knife out of their pocket and started twirling it around in the air, you'd take it if you're a teacher. And if you don't, let's find a teacher that will. So I don't want to link the knife with the phone, but it kind of is the same principle. Take out something that's banned, and I'm going to take it from you so I can continue my lesson. I have to do that.
And I don't think that's an extreme example, the knife, Greg, because one of the things we hear more and more from teachers, and unions have spoken out about this, is the level of violence at schools against teachers is really going through the roof, and it's absolutely unacceptable, and I think it all feeds into the consequences-free zone we are in. So I think this is a great policy, and let's see aggressive enforcement of it.
And Emory, I think, again, the infrastructure does matter. They need, they've been telling me this all weekend, they need a means to securely lock up phones. They've asked for years, give us that means so we can store safely confiscated phones. They don't have it right now. So we got to all fight an angle and advocate for teachers to have that sort of setup. And right now they're telling us they don't even have desks that lock anymore, which is incredible to me because every teacher we had a locking desk.
Or they have, sometimes they don't even have, they have shared desks, so
right.
Desks with other teachers. But I think one of the things is that we have to be careful as adults that we don't do, because our parents did it, is to romanticize what it was like when we were in school. Because that's what we do. We romanticize what it was like when we were in school. You know, my parents told me how many miles they walked to school. You know, things change. You can't keep comparing things to the past. And we can't keep generalizing and saying, oh, schools are all this way. It's all, you know, the parents will defend their kids and blah, blah. You know, let's stop with the generalizations and romanticizing our youth. And, you know, pay attention to the, you know, something we didn't have when we were kids. We didn't have lockdowns either.
No.
Things are different today.
Yeah.
But Emory, things have changed. I mean, the culture has shifted. I take your point, but I don't think there's any denying, you know, the consequence-free thing.
Oh, I can't assume that because, you know, I have my youngest child just been, you know, they've just gone through the school system. And I don't remember that at all. When he got in trouble, he got in trouble.
I feel like the strap. We'll save the strap for another segment. I never got it, but the guy brought it out. The principal brought it. I was like 7 years old. He brought it out right in front of me, and he goes, this is what it'd be like. And he hit the desk as hard as he could, about 5 inches away from my hand. And I'm like, I'll be good from now on. So we're probably not headed in that direction. I will admit that.
I hope not.
It straightened me out. I'm not sure I stayed on the straight and narrow from age 7 till now, but I did my best. All right. Another education issue I do want to get to. And this is concerning, but it has those layers of the political world that we certainly live in right now. It looks like the Halton District School Board has told a guidance counselor, you're staying home until we figure out what to do about this. This video is from an incident, and the audio of it is from an incident on Friday that showed a guidance counselor using language towards a student. She basically said, you wearing a keffiyeh, that reminds me of a terrorist. And this exchange followed from here.
So I'm not a terrorist and you don't treat me like a terrorist, but I look like one.
That reminds me of.
Oh, so I don't usually look like one, but when I put this on.
That reminds me of.
Oh, okay.
Can I keep
the phone? Alright, perfect.
It does.
Okay, so I just want to talk to the rest of the school, because like, me personally, I feel offended.
Anne-Marie, not great. Not great at all for this particular guidance counselor. The principal at that school has condemned the incident in a statement posted online, noting the staff member's been sent home. And it's concerning. There's a lot of this in our schools right now. There may be kids that are coming down to the offices and saying, hey, I'm Jewish and I'm scared because of things that are happening. I knew, we all knew past October 7th that schools were going to be a bit of an elevated zone for negative energy. And here's another example.
Yeah, I think it would be lovely to hear the whole exchange because, you know, context is often everything. But I think this focuses on another ban that's not working. And that's the legislature has banned it. And that's now they're in this kind of stalemate that's going to continue. And, you know, the answers aren't simple for this situation. But she obviously didn't use great judgment wading into that at all. It was unnecessary for her to make any comment whatsoever. And, you know, I just can't wait for this conflict to be over, because we'll start to see it, you know, things go back to a little more simple times. But right now, it's the policing again of this issue is going to continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it makes me fearful for both our Jewish community and for our young people, for our Palestinian communities. It's going to be a very rough go.
Tricky territory, Anthony. I know I can understand a parent saying, I don't want that educator back in the school. I also don't know if she just gets bounced to another school and it becomes somebody else's issue. But I also don't know where we leave ourselves with teachable moments to evolve about language. It's a very difficult one for me. I wouldn't want her at my kid's school today, tomorrow, or the next day. But where it goes from there, I'm not sure.
One of the things that saw police morale drop a lot in Toronto, Greg, is whenever an out-of-context video would get posted online, politicians and leadership at the city would rush to throw the police under the bus without having a full picture. And during my campaign, I said, I will not do that until you have all the facts. I will not likewise throw this teacher under the bus right now when you both acknowledge that we don't have a full picture of what's going on. And we just discussed how there's a lot of chaos going on in the schools right now. So, you know, what's also going on here is the student who said, I'm going to film this teacher and post it on Instagram or whatnot. Has that student faced repercussions? Because that's pretty destabilizing for the class environment as well. So I want to see the fuller picture here.
But that's fair. And she should get that in any kind of tribunal from the school. But I think we're allowed an instant snap reaction. And if I watched her say, the keffiyeh reminds me of a terrorist. She said yes to the student after he said, does it remind you of Hamas? She said yes to that.
Correct. She's not giving a press conference. She's not like running for office with a statement that she spent hours writing here. So you're right that we could really nitpick the particular word and phraseology of this sentence, but I'm not going to do that right here. Was it a perfect phrase she made? No, but, you know, I'd like to know what the kids were doing as well in the broader picture.
And that's fair, but isn't the principal doing the right thing by sending her home until he figures it out?
I don't know, because I think they could probably do a broader review. I imagine all the people involved in this situation, they know a lot more than we do already. So these sort of month-long reviews that are really just about making things blow over, I'm not a fan of those either. I find them cop out.
Well, I'm not, and we don't. I don't know that we always do the best job. We'll take a story, and then it's difficult because you got to keep calling the board because they don't exactly publicize punishment or you know, a move or a transfer of a teacher that did something wrong. A lot of these stories get a lot of instantaneous reaction. You're right about that, and then it's really difficult to follow up and find out, well, what happened in that case. Because it could set a guide, right, Anne Marie? It could set a guideline as to where you're going to go the rest of the time. And it's a great moment for other teachers to go, well, that was on the wrong. I was on the wrong side of things with that one.
Yeah, it's difficult. There's two difficult parts of it. One is, I think the school board did, if you want to look from a reputation perspective, they reacted quickly, publicly, took accountability for it and so forth. But always the piece missing, And usually it's because of privacy, is the accountability at the end to say, this is what we did. We investigated. This is what we found. Yeah. And we're going to take, you know, this kind of ownership with it. Because we're dealing with people's personal lives, this teacher's, for example, or their students involved, they have rights of privacy that you have to respect. So it is difficult. But the accountability at the end part is usually the piece that's missing when it comes to reputation management and so forth. But I think they did the right thing by reacting quickly for all the right reasons. This teacher deserves a full airing of what it is that happened. And if this is a moment in time she can learn from, that we can all learn from, that's a good thing then. There's nothing wrong with that. They aren't saying at this point she's going to be fired, yeah. She's going to be this. I think it's just something we all need to learn from.
All right, let's go to the transit world. And Anne-Marie, that's your previous world. Curious to see how you think this will land. Toronto transit workers voted overwhelmingly in support of a strike mandate. It was about 98%. We have not seen a transit strike in this city in a long, long time. It would go back to late May of 2006 when there was kind of a sudden one-day strike that leaves a lot of people with no TTC. We saw even five stations go down Thursday, and it affected everybody all through Friday and Saturday. So when I bring that up, it's pretty important, pretty incumbent upon the TTC to make sure there's labor peace at the end of the day, but also strike a responsible deal because it's a publicly funded service. And if we're paying for big raises, eventually that's either going to mean they need more ridership or they need more money from the rest of us.
Oh, I this gives me nightmares because as a public servant, and I have been after, 12 years in the transit world as a public servant, I was also one at the city where the public health and the public library, and every system I was involved with had a strike at some point that delivered chaos to the city, even the library, shutting down our libraries. Mm-hmm. And it was only a week, but it was chaos. And shutting down the TTC is, in spite of the fact that we think, well, we all can just work at home. 50% of people don't work and never did work at home all throughout the pandemic. They have to get to work somehow. And as if it's not difficult to get around this city as it is, can you imagine with no TTC? And the work, I will tell you this, though, the work that's going behind the scenes right now, they are already exhausted because they have to develop contingency plans in the event. If it does come to a strike, you also have to have a huge communication strategy if there is a strike. And then there's the negotiation that's underway to really get hopeful that they can come to an agreement. And I really hope they do.
Anthony, you around this time last year, you're campaigning, you're running for mayor. You had a lot of opinions about the TTC, its effectiveness, and what needs to be done here. And I make the point, they have a $2.6 billion budget for this year, but they didn't increase fares. With a lot of these unions striking new deals, 5% increase, 6% increase, unless they get a lot more ridership, it's hard to figure out how people don't pay more next year at this time.
Greg, anytime I go on the subway now, I think, is my eyesight getting worse? Because I look up at that little ticker telling me when the next train's coming. And I go, well, that can't be a 9 because I've been riding the subway since I was a little kid. And it's never been 9 minutes.
When was the last time you got your vision checked? That is a very fair question. You should have revealed that during your campaign.
And I'm just surprised by how bad it is every time I go on. Like, I don't use it every day. And every time I go on, there's one of these things that people tell me about you have to get off the train. This one's canceled. The Bloor line gets shut down. They bring in the shuttle buses. It's becoming less and less reliable. And a strike will only hurt the cause for everybody. If a strike had happened during a mayor's race, I would have campaigned on making it an essential service and people would have responded quite positively. Either it's essential or it's not. But at the same time, I'm pretty sympathetic to the fact that it's becoming a more rough and tumble place in terms of a lot of abuse that TTC employees are on the receiving end of. And the affordability crisis is very real. So I appreciate why transit workers want as much money as they can because they're dealing with crazy inflation as well.
It's tough, Emory. It's a unionized job. It's a good job. I've known TTC drivers. I've known my next door neighbor drove a bus for years before he retired. And some of the stories he'd tell me even 10, 12 years ago, I'm like, you deserve every penny you can get. But it's striking that balance, isn't it, with the city and what the workers want.
It is finding that balance. And, part of strike, announcing, we're going on a strike, but not actually implementing a strike. So they just announced, they voted. Mm-hmm. Some of that is a part of a negotiation dance that is underway. And every time I've been there, so many times I've been there, it resolved. But you never knew until the last minute. So that backroom work continues in just to prepare for this city, because the city will be I think I remember the last time we were at near a state of emergency with the transit system shut down.
Oh, my goodness. We got a few minutes here. I want to address even yesterday in the city. It's very difficult to get around. We've all referenced the west end of the city having a lot of subway problems from Thursday on, from Kipling to Islington. Rain never helps, but we've got construction on the Gardner that works through the weekend now. And yesterday was a CALSA Day parade. And this has grown now to be, I can't believe this figure, the city's third largest parade. So, Anthony, I'll start with you. It is important. It's part of our cultural mosaic to have parades, to have gatherings. But they shut down Lakeshore on a day when the Blue Jays are playing. People are coming into the city. The Gardner's already an absolute mess. I don't know the line here between allow, and there's going to be all sorts of charity bike rides starting where we close the DVP and we close the Gardner and we close main streets. Then there's Pride. It's tricky, right? How do we balance respecting these important weekends and gatherings with getting from point A to B on the weekend for the rest of us?
We reduce them. We reduce the number of times that we allow this by a significant amount. There have been conversations in the past about making these events amalgamates. They happen at the same time. We make people get up even earlier in terms of when these charity rides start and so on, because to your point, it's just shutting down the city. And of course, we all wish these organizations and charities well, and it's great they put on these successful events, but people have to get around, and we're at the point now where Toronto's status as a city where people have a future is being threatened by all of these things combined. The worsening traffic is a major disincentive to investing here, living here, working here. So we got to do all hands on deck, and that includes reducing these things.
Anne-Marie, I know even the late Rob Ford back in 2010 said he wanted to get marathons off Toronto streets and just have people run 26 miles in parks. I don't know how we're going to pull that off. But the point being, this has been an argument for a long time that that we've got enough congestion. We've got a ton of construction. We just talked about the transit not being reliable. I had a friend of mine take 30 minutes to go 4 kilometers in the downtown yesterday. So this is no good.
Yeah, I'm going to completely agree with you guys with this. But the reason why is we are at a really unusual point in time with the city. We've never seen progress happening like we have now. This mm-hmm. is a progress long in the waiting, whether it's a construction of major transit projects. We have so many going on in the city now, exactly what we asked for, and we're getting it. So that's a great thing. We also have a backlog of major road construction like the Gardner, and we have we're building housing like we've never built housing before. So the city is in a bit of a state of chaos right now because of progress. So that we have to think about it. And I think the city's afraid to say no to these charities. But I think the charities should be saying out loud, we're not going to do this to the city right now. We're going to rethink it. We're going to run our fundraising in a different way.
Yeah, let's work together on this, the charities in the city. I think I got 20 seconds. I got to go really quick here. What do you want to finish on?
No, I just said I agree that the charities, I think, should have a conversation with the city. Anne-Marie makes an excellent point that we can have this conversation behind closed doors, and then they can come forward with a productive solution.
Yeah, we may not be able to run it exactly the way we did it in 2007.
Yeah. I'll donate to them if they do that.
That sounds like blackmail. thanks to you both for the time this morning. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Toronto Today podcast. We drop the highlights of The Daily Show every weekday morning at 11 a.m. Don't forget, you can hear the entire show on the radio, at home, on your smart speaker. Ask Alexa or say, hey, Google. Play 640 Toronto or Toronto Today. You can hear us on between 5:30 and 9 weekdays on 640 Toronto. Have a great day.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.